All right. And now since we're not going to look at you, I can just see the waveforms. So I don't have a heart attack.
Think of me as your disembodied computer buddy. Like we're in a 1980s sci-fi and I am the fun computer program that follows you around.
You're the Scarlett Johansson to our her.
You know, I get that a lot. A lot of people think of me as kind of a funny Scarlett Johansson. I get that a lot.
It's the tits. That's why.
Yep. They call me Tits McGee the Robot. That is that is my nickname on Thursdays over at the Smoky Pole.
Andrew, why are you not here?
I am in Washington, D.C. this week doing some sketch videos with Reason and meeting with some other people. And I am flying back later tonight. And that's it. I'm just doing comedy / political stuff up in the nation's capital.
Oh, that's good. I was afraid you went into the woods and just decided that you were the Unabomber now and we're just going to stay out there writing manifestos forevermore.
No, you'll be happy to know, Jen, that the woods in Texas, even at this time of year, can be prohibitively muggy for one Andrew Heaton. So Wednesday, Thursday, and much of Friday were basically a sauna. It was very nice Saturday, though. Saturday was really lovely. And then I head back on Sunday. It's always a temptation, Jen, for me to go off to the woods and just live there with my dog in the camper. But I believe the world needs Tits McGee the Robot. So I continue to make my way back to civilized society.
Well, we'll be happy to have you back when you return.
Yes, we are very, very excited for you to be back in our loving embrace. Is there anything that you're doing in DC? Any fun stuff that that you wanna remark on aside from work?
It's work, but it was doing sketch comedy.
Yeah,
and I love sketch comedy, and I know Justin, you've got a background in sketch comedy.
Yeah.
I have so much fun being on set. Like, sketch comedy is laborious, but it's also you're basically dicking around. Like, you have to write the stuff and you have to perform the stuff. But once you've got the basics covered, at least for the kind that we do on camera, you're just making everybody in the room laugh.
Yeah,
so it's like super friendship time because I've been working with the Bragg Brothers for 8 years now. Plus all of the performance stuff that I need to get out of my system to not irritate people in regular life. And so I was doing lots of that. I had dinner with the great Jeff Maurer, who you've had on your program, Justin.
Indeed.
A former writer for Last Week Tonight. Very funny man. Former EPA writer, too. He's probably the funniest former EPA writer on the planet alive at this time.
And he's also got a new podcast. He's on our corner now.
He is. He is now he's a fellow podcaster. So he's competition. We should no longer be friends with him.
No, yeah. Hopefully you took him out like Kerrigan. Like, I think like that's, you know, just maybe his windpipe and not his knee.
You know, I get that a lot. A lot of people think of me like Kerrigan. And I did that.
In all seriousness, everybody should. I've not listened to the podcast. But I'm nice enough to give it a plug, but only in the backhanded way that lets everybody know that I haven't listened to it yet.
You're a real good friend.
Yeah.
Jeff is a great guy. I will, as a basic habit that I wish everybody would get into, probably not our listeners. I probably don't even need to tell anybody listening to the show this right now, but I feel like it would be of great benefit to the average American at this point when you're thinking of a conservative or a liberal or whatever to picture your smart friend who is that thing. Just picture that person in your head when you're describing the group that you are not. And it will make your life so much easier because you'll be focusing on the positive elements of it. You'll be engaging in a good faith argument. Jeff is, to me, the go-to in my mind when I want to think of a very, very intelligent, sane, well-reasoned Democrat. I'm just like, that guy, like I would feel very comfortable being his press secretary if he were in Congress. And he is one of those people that I always find interesting. So his podcast is called Wrong Think, and good luck to him.
Yeah.
So many wrong podcasts.
I will say to your other point about putting your smart friend in the role of a position for which you find yourself diametrically opposed. I totally agree with that. And I have found myself in my crankier moments recently, just kind of lamenting an age of intellectual uncuriosity that we kind of live in, where I think culturally we have separated ourselves so far into niches, which I think the internet does. And there are great benefits to doing that, to breaking up our monoculture and separating it into different little fiefdoms. But on the other hand, I think that the natural element of that is focusing so hard on our borders that we don't think about why they're there or whether or not they're fair or whether or not we should be extraordinarily stringent or believe that the people beyond them are truly evil.
Or even if the borders are real. A lot of times we're making assumptions about other sides that just aren't even true when you have a conversation.
Oh my God. Yeah.
That is a great point, Jen. Jeff and I were talking last night and I was like, I think my political philosophy is just Jeff Maurer minus 20%. Like whatever Jeff wants to do, ease it back a little bit. That's probably what I want to do.
So you're only kind of into soccer.
Yes. Exactly. I'm kind of into soccer. No, because he'll be like, we ought to do this program. And I'm like, I think that could work, but I think you're giving it a little bit more credit. I wouldn't, you want to do 20 billion. I would do like 5 billion like that. Like it's a matter of degree. It's not even a diametrical opposite. There are no hard boundaries. And Jen is right to point that out. A lot of the time, and so much of the time, the hard boundaries we have are tribalistic bullshit. Like it's just, you're saying social justice, but I'm saying patriot. Therefore, we're on enemy teams. We have to hate each other. And we're not actually going to figure out what you want, what I want, or if we could figure out a way to work to get that thing that we both want. I know you used a bad team word, and you've got a Texan accent, and I used my team word, and I've got a Maryland accent. So let's fight each other in the street with rakes.
Well, here's the other thing. Can we have provocateurs that are actually provocative or interesting or are doing things that challenge ideas? I feel like the modern provocateur is very, very sad. It's sad and pathetic. Like this podcast series just wrapped up about J.K. Rowling, right? Mm. And look, I'm not here to say that the issues for which J.K. Rowling has found herself in the middle of or her opponents are one way or another. Like that is a conversation for which I think that the podcast did a good job of laying out and people can digest it on its own terms. But at the same time, J.K. Rowling is a pretty bog standard British lady leftist. Like if she's the one that is, you know, like, oh my God, the great provocateur, J.K. Rowling, the children's book author who wrote two letters. It's like, where are we? Like there's no Gigi Allen here. there's no gigantic statement being made that is totally off the reservation that is having people pull their hair out. This is, I don't know. I feel like we're making more and more of a meal out of smaller and smaller disagreements.
Well, I think there were provocateurs, like real ones, but they've all been scrubbed from the internet.
Yeah.
So JK is allowed to be there, but, you know, Milo's not.
Shout out to South Park. I feel like South Park is a provocative show and has been, but it's really fucking funny.
Well,
it's consistently funny.
It's very funny. And they've ascended to kind of like Mark Twain level where like, they're so brilliant. You're like, whatever. Like, you know, it's part of gravity. It's like, yes, Matt Stone and Trey Parker are going to have really, really funny ideas about satire. And that is only because of their own brilliance. They have ascended to a level of comedy heaven for which very few, if any, get to dwell.
Well, in longevity, I think the fact that they've been doing it so long is how they get away with it. If they were to start this show now, they'd get canceled immediately if they even get picked up. So I do think that having started this in like 90s.
I was in high school.
Yeah.
99, yeah. I would guess. Yeah.
Yeah. So they've been at it for decades. They're a lot harder to cancel because they're just such a part of the culture.
Well, also they're like the longest tenured employees at Paramount, which used to be Viacom. It's like gone by three names since they started that show and nobody's worked there longer.
Yeah.
They know where the keys are.
Yeah.
You're right. We're three popes into South Park. Like they might very well make it 4 to 5 popes.
And I hope they do.
From Austin, Texas, I'm Justin Robert Young.
I'm Jen Briney.
And from our nation's capital, I'm Andrew Heaton.
And we're not wrong. On this edition of the program, we're going to be talking TikTok, as well as whether or not celebrities are being unfairly run out of Los Angeles because of an onerous mansion tax that, as you listen, may well have already gone into effect to end homelessness forever.
We're going to cry for millionaires today.
Yep. We're going to shed sweet, fat millionaire tears, which look better than when you cry for the poor. Also, your emails But first, we begin with TikTok. In his first appearance before Congress last Thursday, TikTok CEO Xu Chu was grilled by lawmakers who expressed deep skepticism about his company's attempts to protect U.S. user data and ease concerns about its ties to China. It was a rare chance for the public to hear from Chu, who very rarely does interviews. Yet his company's app is among the most popular in America, with more than 150 million active users. And by the way, let me say this. They announced 150 million active users. The last time that they announced a figure of active users, it was 100. Like, it is growing extraordinarily fast. The hearing was a rare bipartisan firing squad. Democrats and Republicans differed on why they were criticizing TikTok, but they all agreed that the app was very dangerous. TikTok says that the removal or forced sale of the app is a massive free speech violation and a disruption to millions of dollars worth of small businesses, which are derived via the app. Furthermore, TikTok says that they are in the process of activating Project Texas, a solution whereby data would be stored on Oracle servers for which their parent company could not access. The Biden administration has also been in lockstep with the anti-TikTok push. During Thursday's House Foreign Affairs Committee hearing on the state of American diplomacy, Colorado GOP Representative Ken Buck asked Secretary of State Anthony Blinken if he believed that TikTok is, quote, a threat to United States security. I believe it is. Yes, Blinken answered. Secretary Blinken has an active TikTok account, which most recently posted on Monday of this week after he said on the record that it was a threat to United States security. The White House has had a schizophrenic view on the youth-focused app. In October of last year, 20 TikTok influencers were invited to the White House by Joe Biden. He made cameos in many of their videos that they created during the trip. Biden's stance on the app now, that they should sell to an American company. Is a sale possible? Not so fast, says China, where ByteDance, TikTok's parent company, is based. Quote, if the news is true, China will resolutely oppose it, said the Ministry of Commerce spokeswoman of China about a potential sale. Jen, you watched the hearing. Did it convince you that TikTok is a threat to America?
No. If anything, it was the opposite. I've been resistant to putting TikTok on my phone this whole time. In fact, I didn't have a TikTok for Congressional Dish until I talked my assistant into making it, basically apologizing to her for asking her to put Chinese spyware on her phone. And her answer was actually pretty interesting. She said, well, I already have American spyware on my phone, so what's the difference? And so she started our TikTok account, and like, really, I didn't want it because I don't need to be addicted to my phone any more than I am. But I did have that thing in my mind. It's like, it's Chinese spyware. I'm just not going to. But in watching the hearing, the CEO was so insistent that the Chinese government has never had access to the data, has not asked for the data, and was reminded over and over again by these extremely rude representatives in our Congress that if he lies, that they could throw him in prison. And he kept saying it. And yeah, so I left watching the hearing a little bit less convinced that TikTok even is Chinese spyware. It sounds like ByteDance, and like the way he describes it is that ByteDance is 60% investor owned, 20% owned by the founder, and then the rest is owned by employees. And he was talking about how none of those people are a part of the Chinese communists, at least none of the higher ups are part of the ruling class in China. And the board of ByteDance, 3 out of the 5 board members are American. And I didn't know any of that from the clips I had seen from the hearing, because I saw the clips before I watched the whole hearing myself. None of that was highlighted. And what was fascinating to me is I don't even know why Congress bothered to have this man fly out from Singapore to testify. Because first of all, he's not even Chinese. He's from Singapore. But they flew him out here, had him testify, and he would tell them things. And then they would immediately be like, well, we don't believe you. This is a Chinese company and you're a danger to the public. Like, they weren't listening. It wasn't a conversation. No. It wasn't a fact-finding mission. It was
a firing squad.
Yeah, and it was rude. I was really...
Even so, you listen to a lot of these. Like, even on your scale of rudeness during these hearings, this even triggered that for you?
Yeah, it was above and beyond, especially because I've seen the other tech executives testify quite a few times. I've seen Jack Dorsey, I've seen Mark Zuckerberg, I've seen the executives at Google, and they're always treated with some measure of respect. Where this guy was told to his face that we think you're a liar over and over again, and I found him to be very reasonable. He had answers that I feel like we could work with. This Project Texas thing seemed to make a lot of sense to me. The idea is essentially they would store American data on American soil, be controlled by an American company, and would be overseen by American investigators.
By the way, that was the solution that they came up with under the Trump administration, because the Trump administration had initially pitched that, and that was the solution that they came to. They did not implement it immediately, I believe, thinking that they had a friendlier administration coming in the Bidens. That has not proven to be the case.
Well, from what I understood watching the hearing, they've been in the process of implementing it for a while. So they're very close to it being done. So I actually think they did start it before the Biden administration. They must have, because it's so close
to being
finished.
That was the agreement that was put into place. Now, whether or not it needs to go at a certain pace or whether or not it would have gone faster if Trump had won, who knows?
Yeah. It sounded fair enough to me. I don't really give a shit which administration it originates from. I liked what I heard, essentially. I mean, especially considering I had just finished my episode on the Twitter files, where I read the Twitter files and I watched a bunch of hearings about them, and knowing that we now have, and I know we've talked about the Twitter files before, but until I sat down and really read them, I didn't realize how formalized the system of government to private sector censorship is here in the United States. And one of the themes in the TikTok hearing that I found fascinating, and I'm going to put in my next episode of Congressional Dish, was how many of our representatives were telling TikTok, you're not censoring enough. How do we know that you're going to censor all these things? And so I know that even members of Congress are using this government corporation partnership that they've developed with the so-called American social media companies, Twitter, Facebook, Google, Reddit, LinkedIn was on there. I mean, all of them.
Yeah.
They know that they can get those companies to censor. TikTok, they can't. And so one of the things that the CEO kept saying is that we don't censor for any government. So he'd say, we don't censor for the Chinese government. We don't censor for any government. And I think our representatives took that part as a problem because they heard, we can't use you to censor. So, I was really surprised by my own reaction because I was biased against TikTok going in. And now I wouldn't be all that nervous.
Are you
going
to be doing
a
dance challenge?
You know, my niece really wants me to. Yeah. She's really good at the K-pop dances. So, I think eventually.
Maybe.
Yeah, I think it might happen.
Maybe you will do a dance challenge.
Well, it seems really fun. And the whole idea that you have to censor on TikTok in particular, I find silly, because there are people that are making very good money on TikTok being debunkers of bullshit. And so the idea that we need to have this government, whether it's our government or Chinese, to censor on TikTok, like, one of the things I think is cool about TikTok is that they have enabled their users to take other people's content and respond to it. So there is this built-in bullshit debunking machine within TikTok, and their algorithm is what the Chinese government is trying to protect.
Yes.
So it's not even necessarily that they want to have control of TikTok for any of these censorship allegations that our representatives keep throwing at TikTok. Oh, and by the way, a lot of these allegations, the CEO kept saying, like, that's just not true. Like, you're accusing us of doing this stuff that's just not true. And it happened over and over again. But the Chinese government, they've developed this technology that TikTok is using, and that's what they don't want to end up in American company hands, which, I mean, look at what our own government does. Like, we do all kinds of protectionist stuff to stop the Chinese government from getting technology. And so you can kind of understand the hesitation there, where they wouldn't want to just let it go.
I do think that that is something for which American, at least on the American negotiation side, the argument is that the United States does not stand up enough for their IP, and that China rips it off more than we are getting out of it. Now, that's an American perspective. That's an American negotiator point. Heaton, is TikTok dangerous and should it be banned?
Yes, Justin. Hey! TikTok's dangerous. is, you see, it's a communist app. And the authoritarians in China, they can use it to spread propaganda to undermine constitutional values, which is why I believe we should preemptively undermine constitutional values ourselves to stop them from doing it. So, for example, the free speech people use on the app, we can't let them be doing that because maybe they could use that free speech for Chinese things. So we need to turn it off. And I think it's silly. I agree with everything Jen said. The idea.
See, this is why you need a catchphrase. Because you need a line in the sand before...
Put that in your julep.
There we go.
Honestly, that character you just did just gave me PTSD from the hearing because you sound exactly like members of Congress.
Down in Louisiana, we believe that the government's your daddy. You can't be trusted with a smartphone. You're not a free citizen of a free country. You're a little petulant child, and you don't own your phone. Uncle Sam does, so we're going to tell you what to put on your phone. I think it's silly for multiple reasons. I think it wouldn't surprise me at all if the communist government had some sort of backdoor operation to manage to get into the legal side or the leadership side of a company that's affiliated with it. In that it's a regular tactic in China for the government to own a controlling interest of an industry it cares in. Now, it doesn't care about this particular industry. It really cares about construction and it cares about other ones, but it wouldn't surprise me if they have something like that. That said, the data itself sounds like it's reasonably secure. Even if it weren't, what are they learning from the data? I mean, I can already tell them, China, you want to know what TikTok will tell you? Teenagers love videos of other teenagers pulling pranks, and Americans in general love dancing jailbait. There you go. I just saved you a lot of money and time, China. We love jailbait. That's what I learned from TikTok. I don't think that it has the actual security threat that it's made out to be. Makes sense to me not to have it on government phones, but I would be more cautious on government phones in general. And the actual security threats that are brought up of like, you know, what if they learn something from this? Well, they can learn stuff from Twitter. They can learn stuff from LinkedIn. They can learn stuff from YouTube. If you're a Defense Department person and you're doing a twerking dance at your desk with documents in front of it, we need to have a conversation about that. But that could be scrutinized over YouTube. So I don't think that it's a big deal. And more to the point, I'm bothered by the authoritarian elements that are present here. Jen, you alluded to the censorship. I think that's an excellent point that it's not really censorship and we censor it for some reason. But beyond that, like, guys, it's my phone. If I want to put something on my phone, go fuck yourself. I own the phone. You're not my dad. I'll put whatever I want on my phone, period. I'm going to draw the line at child porn. But like, other than that, if I have an app that I feel like having on my phone, fine. Uncle Sam need not get involved. I also
Heaton's
don't like the
put
idea.
Put child porn on your phone to own the feds challenge.
I'll add to this too, that, I don't think that it's a great idea to try to get into a grudge match with China over technology, in that, for the benefit of Chinese people, Apple is selling phones in China right now. That's great. The reason that Apple has fought censorship over here, like you guys remember a few years ago, there was the shooting in California and the local police department, the FBI, wanted Apple
to crack the
break the encryption on the phone so that they could get the information, and Apple wouldn't do it. I think the reason Apple didn't do it was because they know that one of their biggest markets is China. And if I were in China, I would sure as shit be buying an iPhone, because that is encrypted and the Chinese government can't spy on me with it. I can actually text my friends and things and do email without them looking down my back and putting me in a concentration camp. I want to keep those iPhones going to China. I want to keep the dissidents having some method to encrypt things. And I like the idea of American technology going over there. So I think this whole thing is a really big opportunity for politicians to get fired up and energetic about xenophobia and a big bad guy and look like they're playing the role of the American protector in a situation where there are no stakes for them and there is no downside to them. There's no constituency for TikTok, so.
All right, but let me ask you that on that thought. Why now? Because we did not see this during the 2020 election. It's not like Biden ran on saying that TikTok needs to be banned. This is something that has gotten a lot of momentum really, really, really fast.
I'll take this one. So I think there's two factors in the why now. One is the anti-China hysteria in this Congress is getting truly demented. One of the things that I do for Congressional Dish is I go through the Daily Digest, which tells you what happens every day. And so that's how I make my list of hearings that I'm interested in. And it's a very long list. And I I swear to God, like half of them from this Congress are about China. And it's all about how China is the worst in every way. And then just watching this hearing, and then like Senator Mark Warner, this is what I'm reading tomorrow, so I don't have details on it, but he has created this Restrict Act.
I actually do have details on that.
Yeah. So
I read it today.
Okay. Yeah. I'm going to outline it tomorrow because I know enough to be concerned. But when Warner created this bill, he went on Fox News and was basically just saying like, I'm not anti-TikTok, I'm anti-China. So I think that's a big part of this, is where TikTok is in some way connected to China. Although watching the hearing, I now have doubts about how strong that connection actually is. But I think there is a lot of anti-Chinese sentiment behind that, that the American people don't feel, but that people in Congress and in the White House do. The other factor is that Facebook in particular, Meta, has been lobbying the shit out of our Congress. You can already see that Meta, by taking TikTok and basically like ripping off that idea for Reels, but not doing it as well, and having TikToks themselves ending up being the Reels. Like, I'm not even on TikTok and I see TikToks all the time because I use
Instagram. It is very influential.
It's very influential.
Not only on Instagram, but also YouTube Shorts and on Twitter.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Everywhere is TikTok. It's clearly taking over the social media space. It's a direct threat to Facebook. And as we know, I mean, Andrew, you've told us this, that people that don't know a lot, they will rely on those they do know, a lot of times lobbyists, to give them background information. And what I saw in this hearing is that our members of Congress have been fed enormous amounts of bullshit that they believe to be true. And even when told by the CEO that this stuff isn't true, they believe it anyway. So I do think that the lobbying by the American social media companies is having an effect on these boomer brains. Because like that Restrict Act that was written by Mark Warner was written by 90% boomers. So we're also talking about a generation here that is not known for being the most tech savvy. And so these people are trying to legislate something that they don't understand. They're getting information from Facebook representatives, because God knows that TikTok doesn't have very many roaming around the halls of Congress. And so I think that convergence of Facebook losing market share and the anti-China hysteria that's happening in our Congress right now, I think that is what explains the why now-ness.
Let me give voice, because nobody said it. I do believe that ByteDance is compromised by the Chinese Communist Party, and I don't believe that they'd be able to operate Douyin, the Chinese version of TikTok, inside mainland China in the way that they do, at the numbers that they do, if they don't. There's very, very few apps that have had that kind of footprint that do not have, that are not influenced by the Chinese Communist Party. So I do think that that is a concern. Now, whether or not that means that TikTok should be banned is a different story. And I do think that
are you comfortable with the idea that that our data being firewalled would be enough?
No.
Like, isn't that what they're telling us the threat is?
And again, this is where it's what they're saying, because the reason why that was a firing squad is you had the China bad stuff, which is now more bipartisan than it's ever been. And then you had a lot of ills of social media. And that's another reason why I think this has become a more popular thing for politicians to wail on with very little impunity, is that we've had a moment recently, and a lot of it from Facebook's whistleblower that had a moment last summer, that social media is not only more and more harmful, but specifically harmful to teenagers, and even more drilled down, harmful to young girls. And that is an element for which has led to a conversation about regulation and whether or not whether 13 is the right age that you should be allowed to make an account on social media, then
regulation,
maybe it should be higher.
Social media, though,
whatever.
Not just TikTok.
Well,
I think I speak for everyone when I say that you could trust Congress with 14-year-old girls. I think the best way to protect 14-year-old girls is to just give them to Congress. I think Congress is pretty on the ball.
So with that being said, that's where a lot of the other criticism came, which I do think was unfair, of whether or not, you know, like, oh, all this negative stuff happened. There was a horrifying story about a kid who killed himself after watching a TikTok video during that hearing, that I think you can find, unfortunately, legions of examples on many different platforms about teenagers who have done horrifying things to either themselves or others after watching some element of social media. And TikTok got blamed for that. Do they own a share of that? Sure. Like all social media companies, they probably do. But do they own all of it? No. In the same way, I don't think Instagram should own all of it. If there is a law that we need to change, and we should change that law. That being said, the data that we are talking about is something that I think is a battle for which technically may or may not matter. Like whether or not Project Texas exists and there's it's stored on American servers. The larger question is, are there compromised elements of TikTok by way of Chinese espionage, in the way that espionage agencies from all over the world, up to and including India and Saudi Arabia and the Qataris,
and are often
here's the other. I do think that there should be a different, like, a question of like, all right, for our own security agencies, and we can have the conversation for as long as we want on our own security agency spying on us. But at the very least, I think we could all agree that if we don't like that, we should definitely not like foreign agencies do. And I don't think that we should just throw up our hands and say, oops, well, it's happening here, so I don't care if it happens anywhere.
Hold on now. So if we want to talk about putting in firewalls and security measures in place, I'm fine with that. But the problem that I have with this is that we're saying we don't like the Chinese government, which I don't, by the way. I am anti-Chinese government, although I want to make a clear distinction here. There's a difference between China and the Chinese government.
Okay, whatever, bigot.
We're not talking about a goddamned anthill. We're talking about a bunch of human beings and the government that forces them to do stuff.
I agree. And I trust our audience to understand that when we talk about the Chinese Communist Party or the Chinese government, that's what we mean, and not the huge untapped audience of We're Not Wrong listeners that could be in China downloading us.
Billions of them.
I don't know that our legislators always mean that. I do think some of our legislators really see China as this kind of monolithic entity. I don't have a problem with their people. I have a problem with their leadership. And I don't like their leadership because they are authoritarian tyrants by any definition. But I don't want to try to fight that tyranny by becoming authoritarian on our end. The way to fight the censorship that they have, the control, the mind control, the Orwellian bullshit they have, is not to develop our own American Orwellian bullshit. The way to do it is to double down on the stuff that makes us different than that awful regime, which is saying we have freedom of speech, and TikTok is a vehicle for that. There's a tremendous amount of people in the United States that can now connect with all the other people in the United States whenever they want and say whatever they want without going through a gatekeeper. This is something that facilitates freedom of speech. Private property. I own my phone. Unless I'm hurting you with it, I can do whatever I want with it. I don't need to have dad come in and take it away. So I don't like where it's headed. I'm being wary of the Chinese government. Yes, on board. And if we can do something to assist Uyghurs or general freedom in China, that's terrific. I'm in favor of that. But I don't think the way to do that is by removing our own freedoms over here.
Heaton, do you believe that broadly speaking, and let's look at all of social media, that we should have a larger conversation about what our data is and whether or not we should own it? Much in the same way that they have in Europe.
I am worried about that because I think that people fail to recognize the downsides of what Europe has done. Europe is very, very pro-privacy, pro-data, and that's great if you make a mistake unfairly maligned and you want to move on from it, and there are lots of situations where that's completely warranted. Where it's not great is if you have done something heinous and you get to cover that up. So like Harvey Weinstein, for example, would never have come to light in Australia.
Well, I think we're talking about kind of two different things, because one of them is right to forget, and the other is being able to tell apps and websites that they cannot track you.
Or sell your data.
Or sell your data or stuff like that.
I'm big about right to exit, but the other thing you have to add in there too is that the trade-off is going to be you're going to have to pay a subscription. So if you want to do that, fine. I don't particularly mind have them looking at my data. It doesn't really bother me. If you want to, that's great. But like, understand you're going to have to pay for your email. You're going to have to pay a subscription, and that might be worth it to you. Where I do think that there's a good conversation to be had, Justin, is in terms of the deleterious effects of social media. I think that that's true. I think that it's particularly damaging to young people. But I don't think the way to handle that is for American congressmen to get a softball opportunity to send clips back home to them, sticking it to the Chinese. I don't think that that's the solution to it. I think the solution will probably come out of the private sector more than the public sector. And it'll be parents having phones that restrict the kind of apps their kids can use. That way parents are making the decision, or it'll involve a big societal shift where we all realize maybe we shouldn't be on 24 hours a day. But I don't think that the state is going to be the ultimate arbiter of a healthy solution to those problems.
Here's my thing. Why do we even have a CIA or an NSA if they're not going to blatantly commit corporate espionage and just GitHub the entire algorithm of TikTok? Like, what are we paying you people for? Like, just to look at our selfies that are in our iCloud repository? Come on, do something. Just go. They already did it to Twitter this week. Like, just do it to TikTok and a lot of this stuff will be over. Jen, let me talk about the Restrict Act, because you brought that up. It is very broad. A lot of people are comparing it to the Patriot Act. I don't want to go there because I think that can be a bit of a boogeyman kind of thing. And we should understand exactly what the Patriot Act was and not dilute it by saying that it's other things. But effectively, it puts in the hands of the Secretary of Commerce that they have to take a few people. I think it's like the Federal Elections Commission, the Attorney General, and a few people. They can then make a recommendation that is extraordinarily broad. It is either against our national interest or other things. And then they can either mitigate, who knows what mitigate means,
anything,
or divest another company if it is from on a list right now. There is a list of like countries for which this can happen, which I'm going to go off the top of my head, so I might miss somebody, is Iran, China, Russia, North Korea,
Venezuela,
Cuba, and this is a really funny one, Venezuela under Maduro.
Yeah.
That's the only one where there's a qualifier. It's Venezuela under. So if Maduro leaves, Venezuela, you're off the list immediately.
Yeah. We're cool with Juan Guaido.
Yeah. If Guaido comes in, you're off. But it is very, very, very broad, to the point where I wonder whether or not it's DOA, because I don't think that something that broad, that TikTok has that. It's TikTok, for a lot of reasons, I think, is a kind of four quadrant voter a thing that if it was gone, I think enough voters that actually go to the polls would be okay with it going away. But it's not 9/11. Like, it's not something that is just going to sweep a lot of this kind of stuff under the rug.
So the Restrict Act, I think, well, the reason the Restrict Act is even on my radar, because it's only been introduced, there's been no hearings about it, hasn't moved at all, but it does have 20 senators from both parties who are co-sponsors. So I think that's why people are caring about this one, and it is
and crazy.
We should.
Yes.
But I've seen this play out before with CISA. So CISA was the law, I want to say this was like 2015 or 16. It was a while ago, but there was a big uproar about it because it essentially would legalize these government corporation partnerships in information sharing. And people had concerns for obvious reasons, because everything they said would happen, we now know from the Twitter files, are happening. And so people were up in arms against this CISA bill. And what I saw is the one that they were fighting, they successfully stopped that, but then a slightly modified version got attached to a government funding law. And that's how it became law. It just got slipped in there. So I think the reason that we have to pay attention to this is not to watch out for S-686, which I'm pretty sure is the bill number, but like the way that this gets shifted and warped, like the real version might come from the House, it might get attached to something. The point is not the bill, the point is the effort.
Yeah.
And what I'm witnessing right now in this Congress is a bipartisan effort to crack down on these. Anytime someone says these terms to me, I just assume they have DC brainworms, but misinformation and disinformation, which is whatever the fuck they want it to be. Those are not terms that can really be defined. And it's just things that they want off the internet. And both parties right now think that it is good to crack down on messages that they don't want on the internet. And so I think the Restrict Act is a part of that. That one I think is aimed more at platforms like TikTok, but we are going to see these same efforts like legalizing, I think, what we're seeing in the Twitter files. Like, I think that's going to be the battle of this Congress, because it is a bipartisan effort. Especially when you see this TikTok ban, like it's fascinating to me to watch the Twitter files hearings where the Republicans are definitely like on board with what the problem is. But then when it comes to TikTok, they're just like, you're not censoring enough. It's like, they don't even hear themselves. Like, I think when it comes to censorship, We have a very big problem in the 118th Congress. And what I am rooting for nothing to happen. We need a new generation of people making laws about the internet who understand the internet and understand the threat that this government, you know, this partnership between government and corporations poses to free speech. Because I think there is a, we'll just say like the elites, I guess, for lack of a better term, they really do seem to think that if they're not the ruling party, then all hell is going to break loose. And so what they're going to try and do is to make it so that other ideas and other people can't break in the way that Donald Trump did. So I'm more concerned, bigger picture, with that. And I think this TikTok thing is symptomatic of it. I think Twitter files is symptomatic of it. I think the Restrict Act is symptomatic of it. But the big picture is they want to get control of the messages on the internet. So whether that means cracking down on the platforms that we use or the things that we say, it doesn't fucking matter. The point is that they feel like the internet has gotten out of their control and they want to take that control for the first time in history. And they've got systems in place to make that happen.
Jen, did you see that the White House is now doing briefings for TikTok influencers?
Yeah, and yeah, right? So it's like they'll use these platforms right before they ban them.
Can I just say, like I usually am very like pro young people. Like I don't like, you know, teenagers and 20-year-olds. I don't want to be one of those old angry people. But this is the least punk rock generation in American history. Like it is, it's the
so
generation
square.
That's like
so square.
Authority's cool. Yeah. Like be like the principal. The principal's cool.
Yeah.
Like it. I thought that was gross.
This is what I'm saying. Wait, where's the provocateurs? Where's the TikTok influencer that went into the White House and pissed on the rug? Like there's no shake it up. There's no pizzazz. And now I'm like, I'm the oldest person ever. But like, I'm with you.
Yeah. You know what? Maybe I'm not. This might be a joke, but it might not. But maybe I'm rooting for them to ban TikTok. Because what would wake up this generation that really seems to think it's all cool is banning TikTok.
Especially when they use TikTok.
The
Democrats wrung it out. They wrung these kids out. I hope it blackpills an entire generation to never trust authority again.
Yeah,
because
this is
what they think about you. Every single TikTok influencer, this is what they think about you. This is what they actually think about you, that you are disposable, that you are just, that they'll find another one. They'll find another one of you. You are absolutely not valuable to them. Your platform is not valuable. Your culture is not valuable. So yeah, Biden's going to peek under the desk when you're doing the news and oh, that's great. That one's not going to flop, but at the end of the day, they don't care about you. They don't care about your livelihood. Do not. I hope it becomes deeply, deeply uncool to simp for a politician unless you're cashing a check.
Yeah.
If you are cashing a check and you're on a campaign, good for you. You want to know what? Can't knock the hustle. Influence is influence. But if you're doing it for free, if you're doing it for a plane ticket, then you are, I hope it becomes insanely a stain on which you're not able to wash out and how uncool it is.
And I just dream of this giant youth vote. All these people that are so apathetic, you ban their app, they start paying attention, they start voting, and bye-bye boomers. So yeah, let's ban TikTok. I think that's my stance.
I've come around too. I also want the youth to be black-pilled and understand that authoritarianism is bad. And as a guy actively wearing a sweater vest, it is very sad that I am telling kids to be more punk rock than they are. So yes, if we could figure out a way to make me proud of the punk rock generation and that involves banning TikTok and take back everything I said.
Patreon.com/we're not wrong is where you need to go. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. You get a bonus episode each and every week. And this week we're going to be talking about the New York Police Department. Hey, I'm policing here. And they're going over their overtime by almost $100 million. Yet another headache for a liberal city that has a rising crime problem. How do they deal with it? We will talk about it. Patreon.com/we're not wrong. Let's talk about Los Angeles. City of Angels. Millionaire home sellers are slashing prices and sweetening deals this week in LA, eager to move their properties off the market before a new real estate tax aimed squarely at the rich goes into effect on April 1st. In November, LA voters backed Measure ULA, a transfer tax on big ticket property sales that the city says will generate new revenue streams for affordable housing projects and homelessness prevention. That's good. More money. Known colloquially as the mansion tax, ULA will impose a 4% tax on property sales over $5 million and a 5.5% tax on properties over the $10 million mark. And that tax is paid by the seller. Actors Jim Carrey and Mark Wahlberg are allegedly among celebrities looking to unload their houses before the tax goes into effect, which is 2 days from now as we are recording this. So Jim Carrey, frantic to try and sign the closing papers on that deal. Heaton, so how happy on a scale from 1 to 10 is everyone going to be in Los Angeles when they fix homelessness?
I think they'll be thrilled when they fix homelessness, and it's on target to be done later this week. This is a great coup. Los Angeles has figured out how to end homelessness. It is, first, make it illegal to build dense multifamily housing in 75% of the city, step one. Step two, state of California, make it illegal to raise property taxes on existing homes. That way, cities build lots of strip malls and things instead of houses. Step three, tax Jim Carrey. That is the solution to all of these problems. They've really struck onto it. I don't have a problem with trying to tax rich people to build a social safety net more than everybody. Like, I'm not a flat tax guy or anything like that. I have no problem with the idea of a progressive income tax. The reason that I think that this is a silly law that Los Angeles has passed is I don't think it will work. And I say that with fairly high confidence for this reason. LA has the money right now. They already have it. It's sitting in a bank account. They've got, last I checked, $1.2 billion set aside for affordable housing. That's already there. But they can't spend it anywhere because 75% of Los Angeles, it's illegal to build anything other than a single family dwelling unit, meaning that 70 in the real estate area. And on top of that, whenever anybody in LA tries to build a homeless shelter, all the people in the local neighborhood come out and give their teary-eyed speech about how they truly believe in affordable housing, but not in our neighborhood because our neighborhood is unique and special and you should do it somewhere else. They can't spend it. So even if this works, and I have serious reservations about this working in terms of actually raising money and not having any downriver effects on the rest of the housing market, even if it works, you're putting lots of water in the tank, but there's a kink in the hose. You got to kink the hose before you can spray out that water. So I don't think it's going to do anything so long as they've got all these structural problems in place that they already have. But beyond that, I think that some of the other problems I see with it are, it's not a mansion tax. It's a tax on properties that are $5 million or more or $10 million or more. There's a different rate on it. A mansion tax is a politically expedient way to sell it. But if I were a developer and I bought 3 acres of property in LA to build an apartment building, which LA desperately needs because the whole problem here is lack of housing. And I build an apartment on this 3-acre thing that has a bunch of units in it. And I drive up the value of the property from $5 million, which I purchased it, to $5.5 million. I'm now going to lose 20% of my profit. So maybe I'm just not going to bother doing that. Maybe I'll do what everybody in California does, which is keep zoning for car lots, because that's going to be a more profitable thing for me to do. If you're going to build multi-unit housing that's over $5 million, that's affected by this too. There are some exemptions in place for quote-unquote affordable housing for some nonprofits and things like that. But weirdly, this does not exempt multifamily dwelling units or apartment buildings. So you're also going to disincentivize those from being made. I think that this is not the way to handle this. And I, on top of that too, I'll add, like, California and Los Angeles in particular is not good at building affordable housing. Right now, as we're speaking right at this moment, there is an apartment in Los Angeles County that houses one homeless person that cost the city $837,000 to build. There are 42,000 homeless people in Los Angeles. Doing the math on that, if Los Angeles builds homes like that for everybody, it would cost about $35 billion. So I don't think Los Angeles is going to build affordable housing that it can actually do anything with. It doesn't have the money to build it at the scale they're wanting to do. I don't know why, by the way, it cost $837,000. My guess is because of stupid land use policies and zoning, and they probably have inbuilt packages that it has to go to unions, et cetera, and they're passing out the money and it drives up the cost. But the medium income house in California at this time to build is $600,000, and Los Angeles is breaking that. So If this worked, Justin, I would be in favor of it. I don't think it will work. And again, I bring your attention back to, if you want to fix this problem, you have to unkink the hose. And until you unkink the hose, it doesn't matter how much revenue you get for good purposes because you can't spend it anywhere.
Jen, how do you unkink the hose?
Well, I think, you know, what I find interesting about this solution is it's so capitalistic, because if you just throw money at a problem, like that's what's going to solve it. I think Andrew's right about pretty much all of this, that there's other solutions that need to come here. And I think big picture, California, because it's not just Los Angeles, but California in general seems to think that every person has a right to a home. I don't think that's the case. I think we should shift that to everybody has a right to shelter. And so instead of trying to build an individual apartment for every single person, knowing damn well, like, you know, I'm from Los Angeles. I lived there for 10 years. My family still lives there. Like I see these people, the homeless people. A lot of them are not trying to get jobs. A lot of them are straight out of their minds. Like these are people that society, whether we like it or not, is going to have to take care of. And whether that means we have a place where it's safe to have tents, whether we say that, you know, this section of Palmdale that has nothing in it right now, whether we put porta potties and I don't know, whether we make cities where the homeless can go and be safe and either bring their own shelter, or we take old Walmarts and turn those into giant places where you have beds and just like the basics, where if you want to move out of those, then you can get a job, you can get assistance, like, but that is where you can live in peace. Something like that, I think, is going to be more useful, both in terms of finances and just like the numbers of people. Cause like Andrew said, 42,000 people. And the thing about Los Angeles is it's not necessarily in Los Angeles' politics that's bringing all of these people there. It's the weather. You can survive in Los Angeles year round living outside. So if we just made it humane for people to do that, if they're willing to do that, like designate certain spaces for them. Like, I just think that the solutions have to be different, because building what they call affordable housing, it's luxury apartments that they give out Section 8 vouchers so that three people can live there and the rest of them are all sold at market rate. Like, even that's a fucking scam. So the idea that the solution is just giant apartment complexes that we allow developers to build, like, that's not it. So the idea that we're going to tax these millionaires, like, I don't really give a shit. I'm not crying any tears for these people getting taxed. Like, you know, these people made a lot of money. You know, they can share some of that to make their communities better, especially on their way out the door. I don't really care about the tax, but I think it's important. And I think Americans in general need to focus harder on what their money does instead of focusing on the tax rate. Like, where did the taxes go? What did the taxes do? And I just don't think the goal of a house for everybody is the proper.
You are dead on. What do we buy? Let's all look at it like it's let's all have the same fiscal responsibility to our contribution to the larger goal in the same way that we do when we all order lunch as an office. Because if we ordered lunch as an office and I said no olives and all of the pizzas had olives on them, I'd be a little pissed off because I wouldn't want to eat anything for lunch. Let's do that, but with taxes. Let's just say, like, let's have the same amount of care for that as we do for the other thing, because we spend a lot more money on it. I'll take one more different tactic. I don't think it's worthwhile to turn on a gigantic money hose for homelessness until we have a serious conversation about homelessness in the modern era, because I do think that it is multi-stratted. Yes, there are people for whom in hard economic times have missed rent or are behind on things and their bills have overtaken their ability to earn, and they need a fresh start, or they need a helping hand, or they need something, so they are living outside of their car. That is one element that absolutely exists. I don't want to deny the existence of anybody who wants to have a different story, because there's a lot of different versions of it. But there are people for whom are, and I don't know whether or not it's chicken or the egg, mentally disturbed and addicted to drugs. And anybody for whom who has had addiction in their family knows that that's not an easy nut to crack. It takes a lot of patience. It takes a lot of will. And sometimes people aren't able to pull the nose up on that plane. Sometimes they spend a lot of time in that valley because the human brain is something that is multifaceted and can lock onto things and does not want to be denied the brain chemicals that are surging. And so we need to understand that getting that person a house or building a community for which we can put all those people together, that's a bad idea too.
Yeah.
Because you're taking people for whom are in a monetary valley right now, and you're putting them next to people that are just in a different place. I'm not trying to pass a value judgment. I'm saying that these are two different problems that require two different solutions. And if all we do is turn a gigantic money faucet on because looking at either of those problems or the other ones that I have left out here are ugly, which they are, and they're hard to understand. They're hard to look at. They make us feel bad about ourselves. And so if we just say, even better, take money out of not my pocket, but Jim Carrey's pocket and throw it at it, then the only thing it benefits is contractors that apply for these bids with the city government, many of which are no bids or cronies or stuff like that. And the end result doesn't get any better. If anything, we just bury our head further in the sand and say, oh, well, we made Jim Carrey live in a blimp. like that. I thought that was going to help it.
I would watch that film. Did I previously talk about why I voted against the affordable housing bond in Austin in the last election? Has this come up previously?
No, you monster.
No, it didn't. That immediately first ballot Hall of Fame of my favorite sentences that have come out of your mouth.
I am the only man in Austin, Texas that voted against this. And to be clear on this, I deeply care about homelessness. I've done multiple episodes about this on the program. I donate money to Community First, which is a wonderful organization just outside of Austin city limits because of all the zoning issues that cities have with anybody trying to help homeless people. I very much want to change this. And I also want to be clear, I would absolutely 100% be willing to increase my taxes by 5% or 10% to not have anybody passed out on a sidewalk and be in a good pace. My problem is not spending my money. My problem is people wasting my money.
Yeah.
That's my problem. My problem is with the competency of it. So in the case of Austin, Texas, we recently had a municipal election and it had multiple bond issues on it. And one of the props was, should Austin pass a sales tax or something to get $20 million for affordable housing? And I tried to do my due diligence on this as a denizen of Austin. And what I found out was that there was no plan. Literally, what the city council had said was, this is for affordable housing, but we're not going to tell you how. We haven't made up our minds on what that means yet. It might mean that we build apartment complexes. It might mean that we have vouchers. It might mean that we have subsidies. We don't really know. It's literally, they said, there's one of these 12 things. It's not limited to, but it'll probably be one of these 12 things. And just trust us, we'll use the money in a good way. And I'm like, no, I've done this often enough now that what will probably happen with that money that was overwhelmingly passed, because it sounds great, is that there will be a bunch of really smart developers and really smart real estate people that will figure out how to get that money. There will be a handful of very intelligent recent college grads that are upper middle class white people that will figure out how to needlessly qualified for it. And maybe if we're lucky, a quarter of it will actually help the people that we want to help. And so I voted no, not because I was against the concept, but because I was like, in any other walk of life, if somebody came up to me and went, hey, do you want to invest $100 in my company? What do you do? Tech stuff. We haven't really made up our mind yet. Of course, I'm not going to give you $100 for a vague direction you want to go. I want you to tell me, what are you going to do? What problem are you solving? And how are you going to solve this problem? If you can do that, I'll give you the money. And I feel like so much of the time these programs are, I don't even want to say well-intentioned. I think that a lot of the time they're just cynical and they're apt to not solve the problem. I know I've brought this up on the program before, but New York City is a great example of all sorts of housing problems gone wrong. In the Bloomberg years, Bloomberg made it a rule, like Jen was saying, that any new high rises had to have X amount of affordable housing allocated in them. They had to reserve that. Well, the way it practically works is that you submit and say, I am below the poverty threshold. I should qualify for this affordable housing. You're on a wait list for 3 years. They don't ask you to revise what your finances are during that time. So all of the people that know how to game the system that just graduated from Columbia and NYU, who are literally making $0 because they graduated last week, go out, get onto these roles. 3 years later, when they're making more money than I am right now, the apartment complex calls them and says, hey, good news, you qualify. And the apartment board goes, we don't want actual poor people in our building. We want people like us, upper middle class white people. And they'll just get a nice.
Sometimes Asians.
Yes. Homelessness is a massive, massive issue. But I would say, after having researched this a lot, if you were making a pie chart of causes of homelessness, about a quarter of it is mental health issues that probably need to be addressed by really beefing up the amount of resources we have in terms of asylums and outpatient services, which I would be very happy to increase taxes for and pay myself. About a quarter of it is really bad substance abuse issues that are very difficult to crack, and I don't think there's a silver bullet for that. And about half of it are people who are otherwise functional adults who are living on the cusp of poverty, and rent goes up and they can no longer afford it. Or they get a flat tire and they can't go to work, and now they can't afford to go to their house. For people like that, for most people, because homelessness is a very broad term, when we say homeless, we typically mean people living in tent villages, but there's lots of people that are just staying on a friend's couch that could qualify, or living in their car, or all sorts of different things. For most people, they are capable of integrating into society. They're capable of having jobs, of being okay. But for them to be able to work, we need to have houses or apartments that just don't cost as much. And the way to do that is to increase supply. And the way to do that is to get rid of stupid laws that are designed to make your house cost more by making all the other houses cost more.
That's a good point. And it's important to have that housing, when you get it, be stable too. Because a lot of these people, they'll get the housing voucher, but it's only good for like a year and a half. And then they're out on the street again. Like, you can't really build a life if you're now looking at like, well, I'm going to lose this in the next 6 months. And so you spent those 6 months looking for the next place you can't afford. Like, these people end up on this treadmill of voucher after voucher with periods of homelessness in between. So I think that we also have to make sure that these solutions are actual homes when those people get them.
I think you're right, Jen. And this is something I would, by the way, I'd love to take you and Justin to Community First if you'd ever like to visit.
I want to go.
Yeah, I'd love to.
I would love to take you both. Alan Graham is a city treasure and a national treasure. That like, I'm going to start crying. That man has done so much good for so many people, as has that whole community. And when I interviewed Alan Graham last year, one of the things he talks about, Jen, is exactly that he wants people that are a part of that community to know that it is a home and not a temporary flop house that they're catching their breath from. So they make it clear when you move in that you can stay here as long as you want. You still have to obey the laws of the land. There's a nominal amount of rent you're paying, but it's like $200 a month or $300 a month. I mean, it's well below market. And also, they'll find a job for you if you can't afford it. But they, like, not only are they saying this is yours until you die or you want to leave, like, they've even built like a crematorium there so that when you die, you know you'll have a place to be. You'll know that your death will be with dignity, and that you will have a place to belong forever. And that is an important part of this. I think having places like Community First are very important. I think that's part of the solution. But a lot of it is just making more housing. We get into a weird upper class kind of economic puritanism that I think screws over a lot of people, where we, the people who are comfortable, look at a situation and say, that is beneath your dignity, so I'm going to outlaw it. To go back to New York, New York used to have lots of, I don't know what you'd call them, basically adult hostels, where you would have a room, you'd have a bedroom and a shared living space, and there would be a shared bathroom and a shared kitchen. And it was very cheap. But New York has banned any construction of such things moving forward. You haven't been able to build them in 30 years, and all of the old ones have been phased out. But like, that would reduce your rent by half. Like, you could have a lot more people not on the streets in LA or New York if you had such things, but we've made them illegal to do so. And what we keep doing is we look at a ladder, we look at the bottom step of the ladder and say, God, that's horrible. No one should ever be on that step. And we break it. And now nobody can get up the ladder.
Heaton, that is very, very well said. I do believe that the organization that you talked about is indeed something that we should all appreciate. And I would love to go visit with you. I think that you're the emotion in your voice is something that everybody can appreciate. And it's the only reason why I'm not making fun of you for picking two zoning topics in a row.
Thank you.
We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. We're not wrong pod at gmail.com. No one gets out clean, right? The discussion on whether or not to prosecute Trump left out the reality that any decision either way would be political, not just the decision to charge him. Not charging him says that the political leaders are above the law, and anyone in such a position can get away with anything if they label the consequences of their own actions to be political vendettas.
Yep.
That's a good point. I suppose there is no a political way to do that. It's going to end up being a political decision either way.
I don't think it's a good point. I don't think it's a good point. No, because the law is the law is the law. Would Donald Trump have gotten charged with this if he were not a political figure? Would it even be a thing?
Well, it's a campaign violation. So just by its very nature.
Not the DA thing. No, the Manhattan DA wants to get him on a bookkeeping charge.
Are we now talking about the Trump organization charge?
This is the one that he was going to get arrested for last week, and now it looks like he probably won't get arrested.
Last week was Stormy Daniels.
It is.
I'm having trouble keeping track of all his crimes.
That's not an election thing. That would be a federal.
It is, because he used the illegal expense.
The charge that he wants, and maybe I had not done the research on this until after we had recorded, because we recorded early last week. But when I did my episode on this on PX3, no, the charge that they want to get him on is felony bookkeeping fraud, not an election thing. And even then, if you compare that to John Edwards, who actually took money from actual donors and actually paid off a woman for whom he had a baby with, so you could definitely prove that they had the sex, the federal government could not land a conviction on that. So it is a low... A low percentage charge in general, even if you were looking at it from a federal election thing, which the federal government did look at and said that they were not going to charge. The DA thing for Manhattan would be bookkeeping. It'd be felony bookkeeping fraud.
I mean, if that's a law and he broke it.
Proving he broke it would be the challenge.
But also, would they have cared if he weren't a public figure?
And I don't think so.
Part of the problem here is that it's not that when laws are passed that when they're broken, you automatically get prosecuted. It has to be discovered and enforced, and the prosecutor has to decide it's worth their time. And so I think that's why this listener is correct, that this is probably going to be political either way, because some of the stuff he did probably wouldn't have been scrutinized if he weren't a public leader. But if you don't scrutinize him as a public leader, then you're saying that the ruling class gets off the hook, which is also a horrible political decision. So I reiterate my point that the way to handle this would be just to prosecute everybody as hard as you can once they're in high office.
All right. I'm with that. Bagger Vance writes, the 7,100 cotton bag reuses versus plastic number is a straw man. The Danish study it comes from makes some pretty sunny assumptions about recycling plastic bags, ignores microplastics completely, and essentially assumes that cotton bag production is entirely powered by burning tires and baby seals. The more realistic number, which the study does reference, is 52 reuses before a cotton bag is environmentally better than plastic. Also, single-use paper bags are better than plastic, even if you set fire to them in the parking lot, as Justin has said he does. Let me also say that we got a bunch of emails about this. And the one thing that was a recurring use in defense of single use plastic bags is the reuse of them as garbage can liners. We got many, many, many emails that I do get use out of it, and it saves me money when I am able to save up all of my single use plastic bags and use them in my garbage trash.
I use them for the same purpose. We could also do that with paper bags, though. It doesn't necessarily have to be plastic. But I can promise you that my Blue Market basket bag, my treasured cloth bag, has been used far more than 52 times. That thing can carry so many groceries. God bless Market Basket.
I am well on my way to building a house out of bags from HEB. I now have enough plastic. I can make my own jungle gym, and I would be fine with one-use plastic bags. I think I would consume less plastic as a result.
Money man.
Still, that all still right. makes no sense to me that every time you go to the store, you get a bag and you throw it away and you think you would use less plastic by being that wasteful. Like, I don't understand that, Andrew.
Jen, when you think about zoning as much as I do, you have no mental bandwidth left to remember to bring plastic bags to the grocery store. True. I show up to the grocery store and I'm like, damn it, I forgot again. Give me a new plastic bag. I've never remembered.
We are all different people. And Heaton is certainly the absent-minded professor who might, you know, show up at the HEB and forget pants, let alone his reusable plastic bag.
I forgot pants to the gym one time. I was talking to it was back when I worked somewhere. And I was talking to my boss over the phone. I was getting ready for the gym and stuff. And I walked down the street. I was living in New York and I looked down. And I was like, oh, I'm in my underwear. I didn't even realize that, like, it kind of looked like gym pants. This is one of the downsides, not wearing a suit all the time. How do you know when you're in your underwear or you're wearing gym clothes? I don't know.
How?
Two Hall of Fame sentences in one episode from Andrew Heaton. Money Man writes, the U.S. Reserve requirement is currently zero. I.e. banks can technically loan out $1 for every $1 they receive in deposits. There are other liquidity requirements in place that stop them from doing that. It changed in March of 2020 because the Fed was worried about a liquidity crisis that we had not seen since the Great Depression, and they haven't moved it back to the standard 10% as of yet. I don't know if they ever will. The monetary policy that the Fed uses changes a lot during the Great Recession, and we are now in what they call an ample reserve economy, making individual banks' reserve requirements a bit less necessary to control the money supply, which is what the Fed is trying to do by changing interest rates. So that was, I usually don't do this, but we get a lot of emails on it. I don't want to encourage people to respond to other emails and just make this a message board, but somebody mentioned, I thought a more fly-by-night kind of idea, like, why don't they just make the whole plane out of the black box material? But this was an actual answer to the Fed's liquidity requirements.
Yeah, and it's good information. I read stuff like this, and it just reinforces for me that the Fed should not be in charge of our money this way. These are decisions that should be made by Congress. Our money should be in control of the Treasury Department. The Fed is just not, they're making way too many decisions that I just don't feel like they should have the right to make.
And I will say, I don't feel super comfortable talking about macroeconomics, banking and finance, because it's not my area of expertise. But I will say, anytime Jen Briney and Ron Paul agree on something, I agree on it too.
So
if both of them simultaneously think it's a bad idea, then I also think it's a bad idea.
Okay writes, my city of Plano, Texas is looking to banning short-term rentals. Recently, a prostitution ring and a shooting that could have killed a child if she had been home with her parents occurred in one of them.
What the hell does that have to do with the lease term?
Plano shit, baby.
Yeah, Plano, go after the prostitution rings. Do that.
Yeah.
Go after actually, you know what? Don't do that. Legalize sex work and then go after the pimps. How about that? You guys have handguns. Get the pimps.
And how about you give that kid a gun so they can bust back when people start fucking around?
Yeah, there's the shooting could possibly be helped with the gun not being there, but, you know, Texas, so...
Pronounced Ramaswamy writes, is Vivek Ramaswamy the next Carly Fiorina, or is he the right wing's answer to Andrew Yang back when Andrew Yang was a Democrat?
Justin, I am unfamiliar with this fellow. Can you tell me who Vivek Ramaswamy is?
Yes, you know? I'm not the only one who's clueless.
You don't know
clueless.
Either you guys know? Yeah, don't worry. He'll be he's the right's Yang.
Well, that's great because I love Andrew Yang. So if the right's going to spit one of him out too, terrific. We'll get two of them.
Well, except the thing is he doesn't have the one hook that Yang had with UBI, which was like way off the map, but popular with a certain demo. But he's using the Yang rollout strategy of being on every conservative podcast in the way that Yang was on like every podcast, just full stop when he was running. He doesn't have the one idea. His big thing, he comes from the finance sector and he has been the anti-ESG. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, it's environmental.
This
social.
Is stuff that makes the soy sauce taste good.
Yes.
That's it's where the Rangers play.
Yeah, it makes you bloated.
Yes. So your definition indeed
it's
was
basically the idea that an investment firm can choose not to invest in oil companies, for instance, for environmental.
That is one way to look at it. The other side is that it is woke run amok in finance and investment, and it's going to tank the stock market and blah, 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 and ruin your 401k. So that's his side of that argument. That's a little esoteric compared to UBI, but he has certainly become a younger face in the Republican primary, more Yang than Fiorina, in that Fiorina at some point at least had a credible run for California governor, whereas I think she was California governor or ran for California governor. Maybe I'm thinking of Meg Whitman.
I think it was Senate. I think she ran for
Senate. Ran for Senate? Yeah. I don't know.
She had that amazing Demon Sheep commercial. Remember that?
No.
Oh, I'll send it to you. You'd love it.
I saw the sign, writes, I went to a very interesting play in Los Angeles. The actors were all deaf and the play was nearly silent. The actors spoke using ASL and there are captions above the stage so hearing people could know what's being said. It was an amazing role reversal to kind of experience what it's like to constantly have to look somewhere other than the stage to understand the play.
Oh, I love that.
Yeah, that sounds great. Very cool. Man, plays are, I need to go to more plays. Like, there have been plenty of movies that I've walked out of and I'm like, ugh, that was kind of a waste of 2 hours. I don't think I've ever had a play that I didn't walk out of and go, that was pretty cool. Even the ones I didn't like enough that it was kind of
true. True or false, the last play you went to was Hamilton and you were at the center of a super spreader event for COVID.
False. I have since been to Tootsie.
A Modest Proposal writes, in regards to the audience name, I think we should vote via patron poll every 24 months to select a new audience name. Ideally, the host will be allotted time each champion cycle to plead
campaign.
Well, whatever. To plead the case of we're not going to fucking do it. To plead the case of one of two dominant parties. I like the bigoted knotheads, while the other host will be given time to encourage people to vote for the far saner know nothings. A token number of the audience will throw away their vote on names like the right, so we can still technically call our audience a democracy, and each of the two major parties will blame them for throwing the election when their party loses, but we repeat it every 2 years, so who cares?
Sounds great to me, yeah. I enjoy some complicated electoral proceduralisms for this.
All right, Heaton has designated himself as the marshal to run this. If it doesn't happen, blame him. State Stan writes to Heaton, so glad to hear that you converted from being a private enterprise apologist in a moment that looked at history as to why the U.S. Post Office ceased retail banking. Not because of any incompetence of a public agency, but exclusively because private enterprise, aka banks, lobbied the government to kill off what they couldn't outcompete. Anyway, glad to hear that you're finally on the side of universal liberty rather than limited freedoms for the slim minority of plutocrats and oligarchs.
Sassy pants much?
100%. And let me compliment you on your use of the word liberty, which is, of course, a synonym for postal banking. As in the immortal line from Paul Revere, give me postal banking or give me death, or the opening lines to the Declaration of Independence, which say that God has endowed man with the inalienable rights of life, happiness, and the ability to deposit savings at the institution that subsidizes junk mail. I am 100% with you on all of this. And I promise from now on to no longer look at governance in terms of what works or doesn't work, and rather to focus on how I can feel self-righteous.
You've been Yankee Doodle Panthered.
The sweater vest strikes back.
Spare Change writes, Justin was partially incorrect about challenge coins. It is a drinking thing, but the coins are given by higher ups, sergeants, majors, and colonels. So the person with the lowest ranked challenge coin buys the rounds. Keep up the good work. So I had always heard it as if you had to have it on you. So it was something that you should always have on you. But they point out that if everybody has it on them, which you should, especially in the military where regiment and discipline is something that happens a lot, that the tiebreaker becomes the serial number on the coin. And so that's how you know the low man on the totem pole.
Wait, hey, Justin, you've got Founders Day coming up. Don't you guys have Great Knight coins and stuff? Is this going to happen in the real world?
Brian has coins on for his puzzle boxes. So I would assume that a lot of people who have bought Brian's puzzle boxes would probably have a situation like that. Yeah.
Challenge Brian. Brian's going to have to buy you drinks.
I used to just sell, when I used to sell merch stickers, I had Jury Will Buy You a Drink tokens, but those didn't have numbers on them. They were just a scheme for me to sell people a tchotchke that they would definitely want to keep and never turn in.
Yeah, I did that with sex coupons and it didn't work. It was not a good thing. I regret that.
And boy, are my arms tired. Destiny writes, if anyone were to have asked me which of you would get those coins, I would have picked the same. Cocaine for Jen, weed for Justin, and mushrooms for Heaton.
Should I be offended by that? Why do people think I'm a cokehead?
No, but you should be a little bit more alert and happy based on her understanding of you.
Maybe this means that I speak too fast.
And a dumbass writes, you three are great. Jen is my favorite.
Why did you name that person a dumbass?
I didn't. They did. And I told them that they were the first email in We're Not Wrong history that I was going to read verbatim. I wasn't going to edit it. I wasn't going to change it. I wasn't going to change their name. He just said, a dumbass writes, you three are great. Jen is my favorite. I'm so glad that you pointed that out. It is the only email in the history of this podcast that I have read absolutely verbatim.
Well, I'm glad I'm someone's favorite.
Dumbass, thank you very much. I agree. Jen's my favorite too.
Me too. Boys.
It's only because I wrote the email where I called Heaton a oligarch bootlicker. We're Not Wrong is a production of Dog and Pony Show Audio. Our editor is Will Saddleberg. Yankee Doodle Panther, what's cooking on the orphanage?
I have a great show this week. I've made a new friend in Austin that is an immigration attorney. And rather than doing what I normally do, which is get really high up, you know, what are the benefits of immigration? What are the potential pitfalls of immigration? Is it good? Is it bad? All that stuff. I went really, really granular in nuts and bolts, where I talked to this lady for an hour and a half about how difficult is it to legally immigrate to the United States? What actually is involved there? How does it work to get employer sponsorship? She's charming. She's very smart. So it's both a substantive episode, but a very fun episode. Eventually, I get into like really esoteric stuff of what if it turns out I've got a bastard kid in Britain? I'm kind of getting to that age where one might show up who's like 11 years old by my count. And if that's the case, how difficult would it be to make him an American citizen? And she was really cool and answered all my questions and stuff about like, what if I'm a polygamist from another country and I try to move here with multiple wives? Do I have to shoot one? Do they merge into an archon? Do they share the wifehood? What happens? If you want a fun episode to learn about how immigration in the United States works, you will learn so much on the Political Orphanage this week.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
Bryony.
So I am back.
You're
to
back.
Work.
You're back.
For the first time in a long time, it's not like, oh, I have no idea. So I just released an episode on the Twitter files. That's what I chose to do for the last one, where I watched the hearing with Matt Taibbi, summarized all that, got some footage back from 2018 with Zuckerberg.
You texted me while you were watching it that it was worse than you had even been led to believe.
It was bad. It was bad. And then when I gave the clips to Claire for her to make them, she was texting me like all day, like, this is painful. These people are awful. Like, it was really bad. It was a circus. It made the TikTok hearing seem, you know, quite civilized. That's the last episode that was out. And I was really blown away by the contents of that. I mean, I mentioned it in the first segment, but like just the coordination between government and private sector, like I really didn't have any idea, even though I had looked at the Twitter files, going into it in detail. And one of the things I found really unfortunate is that it was really tough to do. Like this whole idea that the Twitter files are being released on Twitter, it was really hard for me to read them. Like they really need to put them in some place where you can just read it like an article.
He started doing that with his Substack, right? He would put a version of it up.
So Matt, he might have done that for like one of them, but I found something that he did, which is in my show notes, where he was linking to all the different Twitter files. So I was reading them on Twitter. Lee Fong made one of his into an article, but that's the problem. It's coming from Lee Fong and Barry Weiss and Michael Shellen, like all these different people. So they're all doing it in their own way, which is kind of great for journalistic purposes, but just for like,
not ease. Great for readability.
Yeah. For ease of understanding the big picture, it really wasn't great. So I feel like my episode can help people understand the big picture. I understand it better, so I hope you will too. So listen to that one. That one's out now. And then for next week, I'm working on a TikTok-related episode. I'm going to read the Restrict Act very closely and give people the details about that.
reading the Twitter files really made me feel bad for some of the Twitter people. And I think that they were really put in a place where they were getting run over, and knowing some Twitter employees, like, they're not exactly drill sergeants, and they were getting, I think, just absolutely, they were a frog in the center of the road when it came to like national intelligence apparatuses that were, I think, kind of working them. And I don't blame them for getting worked, because it's hard to, you know, when somebody from FBI.gov emails you and says the world is about to end, you need to do X, Y, and Z, to be like, I don't know. Like, that's a lot to put on people at Twitter.
Yeah. The person that was in charge of content moderation, this didn't make it into my show, but she had only been there for like a year.
Yeah.
And she was instructed to make sure that World War III doesn't happen on Twitter's watch. I mean, that is an impossible thing to tell these kids to do. And then I read another article today that was describing the number of these requests. And we're talking like 750 million requests for whatever misinformation is defined as now. And so this is a huge problem. And it's one of the things I think we have to keep in mind is the focus has been so much on Twitter for obvious reasons, because we got those documents. But this same censorship program is going on in Facebook, in Google, in Amazon, in Reddit, in LinkedIn, in all of these different places. Just because we're aware of Twitter, I feel like Twitter's getting a lot of like the ire of the people in this country. But these other social media companies are getting the same exact pressure from the government. And it's not just the FBI. It was the DOD and CIA and DHS and CISA and the Global Engagement Center and all of these private companies that are also like NGOs that are feeding the government these lists of censorship. And on top of that, there's members of Congress. Like, it was so huge. I had no idea how vast this was. I had no idea how coordinated it is. And this is something that is in place now. The Twitter files hasn't stopped it. If anything, what I'm witnessing is the people in Congress now want to legalize it even further. So it's a really important episode.
Twitter does matter more than those other platforms.
Well,
because it's where the journalists are. And the journalists are special people that need to be protected. politics, politics, politics. We have an interview episode with Tom Merritt on Friday, talking about TikTok.
I love him.
From a
great Tom Merritt.
A technical perspective. So some of the stuff, we go into a little bit more on the technical side of the TikTok stuff, a little less on the, you know, free speech questions. And then the episode that is out now is with Kimberly Leonard, who for my money is the best reporter in the country to cover Ron DeSantis. And that is going to be a beat that will only become more interesting. But she works for Insider. She came on the show to talk about this moment where it is Ron DeSantis done. He hasn't even announced that he's running for president. And yet the political chattering class says that he has sunk like a rock. Polls nationally are not great for him. So we break down that we are into the horse race season. And boy, are we going to talk about every rippling muscle and bristling whisker in this contest. So join us for that on PX3. But for this program, for Jen Branney, for Andrew Heaton, for Justin Robert Young, we're not wrong.
Dog and Pony Show Audio.